From WYPR, I'm Sheila Cast. We're on the record. Does a city shape its inhabitants, or is it the other way around? And how much does location influence commerce? Deborah Weiner explores these questions in the book she wrote, On Middle Ground, A History of the Jews in Baltimore. It draws on Baltimore's unique geography, politics, and racial diversity, not to mention a host of colorful characters, to walk the reader through the development of Baltimore's Jewish community.
From bootleggers during the Prohibition era to doctors who played a major role at Johns Hopkins University to civic leaders. In order to really understand the city, you really have to look at the different groups that make it up.
It's On the Record after the news.
You're listening to On the Record, the podcast, a service of your public radio, 88.1 WYPR. Find more podcasts online at wypr.org. And tell us what you think. Send an email to ontherecord@wypr.org.
Good morning, I'm Sheila Cast. We're On the Record. As a major port and an early hub of commerce, Baltimore has long been a magnet for immigrants from around the world. One of those immigrant populations is the focus of On Middle Ground, A History of the Jews of Baltimore. The book, written by Deborah Weiner and Eric L. Goldstein, chronicles the development of Baltimore's Jewish community, especially through the 19th and 20th centuries. It looks at Jewish institutions, prominent residents, and details of everyday life. On Middle Ground was a 2018 finalist for the Jewish Book Council's American Jewish Studies Award. Weiner joins us in studio. She worked as the research historian at the Jewish Museum of Maryland from 2002 to 2013, and she also wrote Coalfield Jews, an Appalachian History. Tomorrow evening at the Ivy Bookshop on Falls Road, she'll discuss On Middle Ground with On the Record producer Melissa Geer. Welcome to the show, Deb.
Thanks for having me.
Talk about how you came to write such a comprehensive book about Baltimore's Jewish history.
Well, when I was on the staff of the Jewish Museum of Maryland, it was really the vision of the executive director at the time, Avi Dechter, to have a good narrative history of the history of the Jews of Baltimore that also was analytical and wasn't just a record, this happened, then this happened, then this happened, but to really go deep into some of the issues involved that have preoccupied the Jewish community through the years. So we realized that it was kind of too big a topic for one person, so we brought Eric on board. He's a professor at Emory University, and he's from Annapolis and has done a lot of projects with the museum in the past.
So how long did you two work on this?
Well, we've worked on this book for probably about 10 years.
Oh, my.
Actually. Yeah, not, you know, on and off. We didn't. Weren't working on it full-time, that's for sure.
The premise of Baltimore's geographic location plays large in the narrative. First, place it for us. What is unique about Baltimore's position, and why is that significant?
Well, Baltimore is the only city in the U.S. that's both a port and a border city between north and south. So both of those aspects really shaped the history of the city and the history of the Jewish community. So when you put them both together, you have sort of the more unique aspects of Baltimore's development.
You use the story of Gustav Brunn to illustrate the idea. Tell us about Gustav Brunn.
Well, Gustav Brunn was a refugee from Nazi Germany. He came in 1938 after Kristallnacht, after experiencing the horror of Kristallnacht and the riots that happened. And he was a spice maker in Germany. And when he came over here, he really didn't have much, but he was able to bring his spice making machine. And when he got here, he was trying to find work and went actually to work for McCormick, you know, the spice maker.
Mm-hmm.
And after a few days, he was let go, according to family legend, because they found out that he was Jewish. So he didn't know what he was going to do, and a local businessman convinced him, well, you have your spice-making machine. Why don't you try to go into business for yourself, which is what he did. And he found a spot to set up shop across from the fish market and ended up learning about the kinds of seasonings that the fish market people sold with their fish. So he thought, well, I can develop a better seasoning mix than what they're using, and he developed what he came to call Old Bay seasoning. And so
So Old Bay, was from the 40s then?
Yes, he developed that around 1940, well, within a few years of when he came to America. So we thought that was fascinating because it really shows how an immigrant family can come here and really have an impact on the city and on the city's culture.
Right, and I want to relate it to your premise about Baltimore's location.
Mm-hmm.
The fact that it was a port
right.
was important because that's where he came, or what? How does his story illustrate that?
Well, in this case, there are a bunch of different things that sort of shaped him being at that place at that time. For one thing, he had relatives in Baltimore, so one of the reasons he came here was because of that. Which is how many people, many immigrants choose where they're going to settle or end up. But the fact that Baltimore was a port and had this major fishing industry and shipping industry played into the role of developing a seafood mix. He also built his business on connections between North and South. So a lot of his the way he got established was selling seasonings to places in Virginia and North Carolina. And the other aspect of Baltimore being an immigrant port was that the city had a major German immigration in the 19th century. Baltimore was quite the German city and had a lot of German breweries, German sausage makers, all kinds of German businesses that were still around in the 1930s and 40s. And he built his business on selling to a lot of these Germans because he spoke the language. They were not Jews. They were German Gentiles. But that really helped him build up his business. So the fact that Baltimore had this strong immigrant population because it was a port and it had these links to the South and it had the seafood industry, all those together helped him succeed in business and led to his creation of Old Bay Seasoning.
And is it that Baltimore location between North and South, the southernmost northern city, northernmost
right.
southern city, that is your title, On Middle Ground?
Right. And we weren't actually the first to come up with that title because it's when historians look at Baltimore, they quickly see that the Baltimore's position between North and South was kind of a motivating factor for a lot of different things that happened here. But what we do is apply that concept to the Jewish community. Baltimore wasn't really a northern city, and it wasn't really a southern city. It was a mix of both.
This is On the Record on WIP. I'm Sheila Cass speaking with historian Deborah Weiner about the book she co-wrote, On Middle Ground, A History of the Jews in Baltimore. She's talking about it tomorrow night at the Ivy Bookshop. The bulk of the book focuses on the late 19th and 20th centuries, but you include information about the first Jewish Baltimoreans in the 1760s who had slightly unsavory backgrounds.
Yeah,
Tell us about that.
Yes, and this was something that surprised us. A lot of the early other histories of the Jews of Baltimore focus on a couple early families who were very prominent and civic leaders. But when we really did the research, we found that the first Jewish person we could identify was actually a convict laborer who came from England on a transport, which is where they sort of shipped convicts over to America to work as servants instead of putting them in jail. Australia is known for that, but it happened here too. So the first person we found was a man named Solomon Gabriel, who was a thief in London. And got put on a transport and was sent to Baltimore. And the reason we found out about him was that he ran away from his master and was, the master put an ad in a newspaper saying, I've lost my servant, Solomon, and described him and, gave an award for having him returned, which I believe, we never were able to follow up, but I have a feeling he ran away and just never came back.
At some point in the 19th century, Baltimore became more attractive and welcoming to Jewish immigrants. What changed?
Well, Baltimore went through a growth spurt around the time of the American Revolution, and it was really when commerce started to develop, and it attracted Jewish entrepreneurs such as the Eddings and the Cohens, who were the two prominent early families in Baltimore, and they were very much involved in civic activities, very integrated into the life of the city, but always also maintained their Jewish religion.
Very integrated into public life. But before 1826, the law said that Jews could not hold public office, correct?
Right. There was a Christian oath requirement in order to hold public office, and this oath went back to colonial days, before Maryland was a state, before the U.S. existed. So this prevented people from Jews from holding public office because they didn't want to swear a Christian oath in order to become, a public official. So the Eddings and the Cohens fought this for many years. There had to be a change in the state legislature in order to change this situation. And their fellow Baltimoreans, people in the legislature and prominent people, were all very much in favor of changing the law. But there was, in the state legislature, there was opposition from other parts of the state. So finally, in 1826, what's known as the Jew Bill was passed, which actually gave Jews the right to swear an oath to a creator without having it be a Christian oath. And what's interesting about that is about just really within a couple weeks after the law passed, Edding and Cohen were both elected to the city council.
Another unique aspect of Jewish life in Baltimore compared to other cities at the time, which you chronicle, relates to Baltimore's large African-American community. Talk about how that shaped the Jewish community.
So Baltimore had a large black population before the Great Migration of blacks to northern cities. Because
it
had
this century.
Yes, because it had a history of slavery and many free blacks, more free blacks than any other city in the country before the Civil War. But it also had an ethnic population, an immigrant population, which further south you don't really see. So you didn't really see this combination of ethnic groups and African Americans until the 1920s in other cities. But in Baltimore, this combination, this kind of demographic goes back to really the late 19th century. So there was always more sort of interaction between Jews and blacks during the early period than what you'd find in other cities.
Interaction. So was that tension? Was that support? What was that interaction?
Well, it was both. It was actually a very complicated relationship. Jews were merchants in African-American neighborhoods, and that had its tensions, but also its good points.
Economically, did blacks and Jews face some of the same issues?
Well, the discrimination against blacks was, of course, much, much greater than discrimination against Jews. Jews did benefit from being perceived as white, but they also, Jews and blacks also did work together in some of the same industries. In fact, the cover of our book, one of the reasons we chose the picture that we chose is that it shows a scene of a garment shop, and there's an African-American worker on the cover along with the Jewish family. They participated in political alliances, but then again, there was also political competition between the two groups. Culturally, also, Jews were interested in African-American culture, partly because of the frequent interactions between the two groups. So you have people like Jerry Lieber, for example, who became a famous early rock and roll songwriter. His mother had a store in an African-American neighborhood, and he used to deliver groceries to black families, and he would hear music whenever he go all, do his deliveries, and that got him very interested in African-American music and led to his career as a major songwriter. He wrote You Ain't Nothing But a Hound Dog and Jailhouse Rock and, a lot of early rock and roll classics.
So the development of Baltimore's Jewish community, does it resemble or differ from other large Jewish communities in America?
Well, both. And in some ways, Baltimore shows the same kinds of trends that you see in other Jewish communities. Immigrants came here. They formed their immigrant enclaves. They eventually acculturated. Experienced upward mobility. They moved to the suburbs. I mean, that really is something that, a pattern that is repeated in cities across America. And that's something that we chart that happened here in Baltimore. But on the other hand, there are also aspects of those very same trends that had a certain Baltimore focus or a special Baltimore way that they happened. So the fact that Jews experienced residential discrimination in many cities, that happened everywhere. But in Baltimore, the discrimination was much stronger than elsewhere, and Jews were much more segregated than in other cities.
And why was that?
And we attribute that in large part to this demographic makeup of Baltimore, the fact that you had an early population of blacks and Jews making up a fairly large chunk of the population, and sort of white real estate establishment wanting everybody sort of kept in their place. And one reason whites did not want Jews to live in certain neighborhoods was they thought that Jews were more likely to turn around and sell to African Americans. So that was one reason that discrimination was stronger here and that Jews were more segregated.
Is there something else that you think really differentiates the development of the Jewish community in Baltimore compared to other big cities?
Well, there are a couple other things. I think Baltimore has a particularly tight-knit Jewish community, and residential segregation actually fed into being Baltimore having a more close-knit Jewish community. People just all lived in the same area. You don't have that quite as much in other cities. So you had more interaction, say, between the German Jews and the Russian Jews. And even though they didn't always get along, they sort of were sort of like one big family with a lot of squabbles. And also, I think the development of a strong Orthodox community in Baltimore can be attributed in part to its geographic position on the border between North and South.
Okay, we're going to get more into that. We're going to take a quick break here. We're talking with historian Deborah Weiner about the book she co-wrote, On Middle Ground, A History of the Jews of Baltimore. When we're back from this short break, we'll ask about some of the colorful Jewish characters and prominent civic leaders from Baltimore's past. I'm Sheila Cass. Stay with us.
This is the On the Record podcast, a service of Your Public Radio, member-supported 88.1 WYPR. You can support this podcast and everything you hear from WYPR. Become a member. Come to WYPR.org and click the donate link.
Welcome back to On the Record. I'm Sheila Cast. We're talking with Deborah Weiner about the book she co-wrote with Eric Goldstein, On Middle Ground, A History of the Jews of Baltimore. It chronicles the Jewish community's growth during the 19th and 20th centuries and the influence they had on Baltimore. The development of Baltimore's Orthodox Jewish community, one of the largest in the country, is quite a story in itself. How did that evolve?
Well, Baltimore has always had very strong Orthodox institutions. Actually, Baltimore had the first ordained rabbi in the United States. So this goes way back to 1840 when the Baltimore Hebrew congregation hired Rabbi Abraham Rice, who came from Bavaria. He really was America's rabbi. People would write to him from all around the country asking him questions about Jewish law because there were no ordained rabbis who had moved to the U.S. at that point. And then once the Eastern European immigration came in the 1880s to 1920s, the Eastern European Jews also developed strong institutions. For example, the Talmudical Academy was created by a prominent Eastern European rabbi. And then the most important Orthodox institution of all was the Ner Israel Rabbinical College, which was started in 1933 by Rabbi Jacob Ruderman. And this institution developed a nationwide reputation. And so people would start sending their kids from other places to Ner Israel to study. And this really helped Baltimore attract a strong Orthodox population.
So the young men would come to study and then, right, like their whole families, or they would stay? Or how did that get to be a big part of the development of the Jewish community in Baltimore as opposed to just students passing through?
Right. That actually did happen, that young people would come to stay and then their parents would come and want to live in Baltimore because they heard about Baltimore through Ner Israel and then found out about the fact that there was they could live an Orthodox lifestyle here very easily. then in later years that New York was such an expensive place to live and Baltimore was pretty close by and already had strong institutions. So when there was really a Orthodox revival in the late 1990s around the country, Baltimore was a natural place for many Jews in New York to come if they couldn't afford to live in New York anymore.
You bring so many characters to life in the book. Tell us about some of the ones, your favorite ones to research.
One person that I enjoyed researching was a woman named Deborah Chesler, who she was a young woman, actually in high school, when she got captivated by African-American music, and she decided she wanted to become a songwriter. And so after she graduated from high school, she wrote songs and, she worked in a shoe store in the daytime and wrote songs at night and tried to get her songs in front of local African-American music groups. She would go to clubs and things like that. And finally, she got this group called the Orioles to listen to her song. And they ended up recording a song called Too Soon to Know, which became a huge hit for them. And according to rock critics, one of the sort of early rock and roll songs. She ended up becoming the group's manager. And one funny story is that she would travel around the South with them, bringing along her mother. So it just gives me a mental image of her and her mom traveling with this African-American R&B group all around the South.
This is On the Record on WYPR. I'm Sheila Cast, speaking with Deborah Weiner about the book she co-wrote chronicling Baltimore's Jewish history. It's called On Middle Ground. Reaching further back, you write about, is it Jacob or Jacob Epstein?
Oh, Jacob Epstein was actually a very important person in the Jewish community and in Baltimore generally. I refer to him as like the least well-known influential Jew in Baltimore. He came as an immigrant in around 1880 as a very young man. Well, he was about 16 years old and became a peddler, but soon moved back to Baltimore and started a wholesale business called the Baltimore Bargain House. And what he would do is he would send peddlers, Jewish peddlers into the South to peddle his goods. This ended up giving him a lot of strong ties to the South. And he became, his Baltimore Bargain House became one of the largest wholesale houses in the U.S.
A huge employer in Baltimore.
Yes. In fact, it became the second largest employer after the B&O Railroad because he expanded beyond wholesaling to do some clothing manufacturing as well.
You write about he would send his agents to the docks.
Right. So he had a ready pool of people he could send because he would send an agent to Sylocus Point to the docks. And when the immigrants got off the boat, he would greet Jewish immigrants in Yiddish and say, hey, I got a job opportunity for you. So these people went straight off the boat, ended up traveling around the South, peddling Epstein's goods, helping to make his Baltimore Bargain House this huge business, and became known as a major civic booster in sort of marketing Baltimore to the South, and also a major philanthropist in both the Jewish community and in the Baltimore more generally.
Several of the leaders you profile are women. I'm thinking of Rosalie Abrams, mm-hmm. The late state senator. Tell us a bit about her.
Right. Well, we talk about Rosalie Abrams and also her mother, Dora Silber, because they're both good examples of the role of women in the Jewish community and in larger Baltimore. Dora Silber and her husband Ike started a bakery called Silber's Bakery, which grew into a string of bakeries. And Dora was very much involved in every aspect of the business and grew the business into a sort of Baltimore institution. And then their daughter, Rosalie, she started out as a homemaker, and then she became a nurse. She was sort of discouraged from her family. Her family was fine with her going into the family business, but they didn't think women had much of a role beyond that kind of thing. And then she went on to be a state senator and very influential in legislation for women's health and welfare, and also the head of the state Democratic Party, the first woman to be the state Democratic Party leader.
For someone who doesn't know nearly as much about the history of the Jewish community as you do, the range of characters in this book is fascinating.
Yes, I think that's one thing that I enjoyed most about doing the research and writing the book was to find out about this wide range of people who played a prominent role in Jewish Baltimore, from, you know, bootleggers during the Prohibition era to doctors who played a major role at Johns Hopkins University to civic leaders. And in order to really understand a city, you really have to look at the different groups that make it up. And I think that's what we tried to do with this book.
Well, congratulations on bringing them to us. Thank you.
Thank you.
Historian Deborah Weiner co-authored with Eric L. Goldstein On Middle Ground, A History of the Jews of Baltimore. She'll be at the Ivy Bookshop tomorrow night in conversation with On the Record producer Melissa Gear. It's at 7 p.m. at the Ivy, 6080 Falls Road. We have a link to more information at the On the Record page at WYPR.org. I'm Sheila Cass. So glad you're with us on the record. Join us again tomorrow.
Thanks for listening to this segment of On the Record with Sheila Cass. You can catch the show on the radio Monday through Friday, 9:30 to 10 a.m. on 88.1 WYPR, your NPR news station. And you can support On the Record and all the other public radio programs that WYPR brings to you. Just click the donate link at the top of WYPR.org. And thanks.